Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. In a world where action movies are constantly exploding at the box office, our heroes take on the monumental task of dissecting and analyzing all aspects of action movies to truly understand what it takes to make a great action film. Ben Bateman, Andrew Guy, in a Popcorn Talk Network exclusive, this is Action Movie Anatomy.
Boom! Welcome to the show! Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy! This is, count them, our 20th episode. And you know what, Ryan? Our special guest, Ryan Brookhart, sitting on the other side of the table. I think you're here
for our
10th episode. I think you're here for all the monumental ones. We did Terminator 2. Now that I remember, I think that was the 10th episode.
That was?
It was.
And this is so special.
You're a very special guest.
See, I thought you just said I was on 10 episodes, and I'm thinking, wow, those little mini-strokes really take a toll.
Ryan Brookhart has not been on 10 episodes. He has been on 2, and this will be a very special episode of Action Movie Anatomy on the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network devoted to talking movies and all things movie-related. I am your host, Ben Bateman, joined today by my excellently dressed co-host with, this time, a purple shirt matching a purple tie.
Look, it's not a big deal. I just have a lot of cool shirts and ties, man. Yes, I cannot wait to talk about this movie. I hadn't seen this movie in probably 15 years. I think I'd only seen it once. This movie is amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Did you go into the store and say, can I get pastel shirts and matching ties?
I just need one pastel shirt and one tie that matches, and I need that 20 times.
We have a 4-for-1 special.
JCPenney, man.
This is
actually a clip on?
No, it's not. Don't touch that.
It's a clip on. Are you sure? This is actually going to be talking Aliens, James Cameron's epic sequel to the 1979 original scariest movie of all time, directed by Ridley Scott. Yep. This is an incredible movie, and I am unbelievably excited to talk about
it. And Ryan here is like this is one of his favorite movies of all time. He's got the life-size alien statue there, as you can see.
Is it up?
I think we're showing the picture of you with your life-size alien, which is explosion. Man. Yes, you actually have
look how goofy and fanboy like I look. Right?
In the time I've known you,
as
how
opposed
many
in real life?
How what? Many life-size characters have you had in your home? Batman.
See another weird
an
question.
Alien, Predator. Do you have a life-size Predator at one point?
Do you have Terminator?
Yes,
Predator. A Terminator.
Yeah,
I have a Terminator currently.
Yeah,
yeah. I think you showed that last time.
Yeah,
right?
You did. That's impressive. I don't think I know anyone else that has that many life-size comic right. book and sci-fi characters in their home.
Right. Which tells you what?
That you that's have the... Never mind. All right, let's... I'm not going to do the same joke.
Right. Let's move on.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
So, guys, this is Action Movie Anatomy, and we are going to be breaking down this movie, which falls into 4 categories that all of our movies, for the most part, try to stick to. And those 4 rules that qualify the movies are, 1, the hero always plays by their own rules, 100%.
Ripley.
The hero and the villain are always the smartest people and or beings, or aliens in this case, in the room. Definitely the smartest.
Yes.
The movie is driven by a police, military, or political figure.
They're military.
Yeah.
They are.
They're all military.
They're Marines.
But she's not.
She's not.
She's a consultant.
But she becomes a soldier.
Yes, she does. And lastly, the movie contains a minimum of 1 explosion, which this movie absolutely has in spades. Yeah. We are going to share our thesis statements in just a minute, but before we do, I want to let you guys know about a couple of things. Do you remember a few months ago when we were talking about those dance battle castings that were going on? Started with Maria Menounos and her friends, Julianne and Derek Hough, and they now have a show premiering very soon on ABC, Monday, September 4th, right after Dancing with the Stars, Dance Battle America. Set your DVRs now. 8 families have been chosen to come to LA and battle. Make sure you check it out. It's going to be epic. Secondly, I want you guys to check out the other Popcorn Talk shows. There is a sister show of ours called Anatomy of a Movie that happens every Friday, Anatomy of a Movie. They break down basically some of the week's hottest films, things that happen.
Mm-hmm.
Great people. It's similar to our show, not segments, but a little bit more just in-depth critical analysis of the movie.
We're also in the process of getting a collaborative episode between us and Guilty Movie Pleasures.
Yeah, we're trying to get those guys on board. So tweet those guys if you want to see that happen. I suggested the cult classic Point Blank, which is a horrible film, but it would be kind of on both fronts.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I want to mention, guys, is we have been plugging iTunes for a while here. So we ask you to review us and rate us to help us stay high in the ratings so our show does well. But in the process of doing that, we ordered Action Movie Anatomy mugs, and we promised you guys that we would give a mug away, one a week, in a random drawing, once we had 10 reviews on iTunes. And you
we
guys
have 11.
Got us 11. So the mugs aren't here yet, as you can see. They'll be here very soon. They take a little while. We're going to announce the first random winner at the end of the episode today. So after recast, stay tuned, and we will shout you out. The next deal is, once we get to 30 reviews, we're going to start giving 2 out of every 3 weeks. So if you guys can get us 19 more reviews, we're gonna almost double.
All right.
Almost double the number of mugs. So let's get into the show, guys. This today is Aliens. We're going to show the trailer. It's a very weird trailer.
Yeah. It's old. It's 30 years old.
But it's not old and weird like the old ones are weird.
Right.
Where it's like, in a world. It's not like that. Yeah. It's like, there's no narration.
All right, let's see it.
It's just scenes.
Let's cue it up. I actually didn't watch the trailer.
It's very strange. Like Rambo was like...
I remember
like,
it, but yeah.
You know, Rambo's like, he's a one-man army. Like, or like that kind of thing. And this is just... Right. Not to study. Not to bring back. But to wipe them out. That's the plan. All right, people. On the ready line. It's like one of these trailers. It's just like, scene.
It's crazy how like that just they figured out that it just didn't really work that way. There has to be narration, there has to be like tension building, you need outside music.
I mean, trailer making nowadays is like an art.
It is an art form, absolutely. I watched the Interstellar trailer number 2 probably like 50 times before I watched the movie.
Oh, at least.
Yeah.
We watched it together probably 50 times.
Well, you know, the original Alien trailer
for the first one.
For the first film had no narration and no dialogue.
Huh.
And this has a lot more dialogue, but it sort of plays off the same idea.
Right. I mean,
it's just a lot of the iconic imagery. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, this trailer ends with the eye sort of opening up a little bit, like an egg sac.
The egg scene is just awesome.
I think it's my favorite part of the whole movie.
It's pretty sweet.
Which part?
The chamber.
The egg chamber?
Yeah.
Cut the power. But we'll talk about that stuff later.
Now, how can they cut the power? They're animals.
They're aliens. They're geniuses.
They don't show the shot in the trailer, though, where the alien is running down the ventilation shaft, and it's like the red behind it,
right.
Which is one of the most cinematic shots in the whole movie, I think.
There's a lot. I mean, this movie is
shot. Yeah, there you go.
These,
see? Sort of splits open.
Yeah.
Love it.
This time it's war. So there's a little voice.
Yeah.
Little narration
at the very end.
Yeah, it's just interesting that it's like, they don't even mention, like, from the person that brought you Terminator.
No, because they shot this movie in the UK, and this movie hadn't even been released yet. And we'll get into that when we get into production notes. People in the UK and everyone that was working on the film over there thought that James Cameron was basically an idiot and didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah, because they hadn't seen Terminator. And he was trying to get him to watch it, right?
He was young, and they're like taking over for Ridley Scott. It was just... Yeah. Anyway, we'll get into that later, but it's very interesting.
So what we still do to start the show out, guys, and this is interactive, so if you have a thesis statement you want to share with us, please let us know, tweet at us, or you can in the comments let us know as well. But what we do is we share a bold statement, sort of like hyperbole sometimes, about this movie that we all feel.
It's not a real word.
A hyperbole?
Hyperboles.
Did I say it wrong? and we try to share our thought, and we kind of defend it throughout the course of the show. And so I'm going to start today with you, sir, our guest, Mr. Ryan Brookhart.
So what did you say that I was... I didn't mean to cut you off. What were you going to say?
I was going to say you had one of the better thesis statements that we've had on the show so far last time.
Oh, yeah, you did.
And actually, it would probably work the same for this movie, which was that all of Cameron's films are love stories.
Right. To one degree or another. It doesn't have to be a romantic love story, but it is a love story. There's a key element to that.
Yeah, it's between
and
her and...
This is a tricky one because Aliens is actually probably my favorite overall movie.
Mm-hmm.
So when we're talking about Aliens, it's hard not to talk about Aliens as two different films.
Okay.
Because there's the director's cut and there's the theatrical cut. Now, I loved the movie when it came out as a theatrical film. In fact, it was one of the few films where halfway through the film, I thought, well, there's a moment. I'm going to run out and buy a ticket to see it again. So I watched it twice in a row.
The first time?
Same day?
It was at the...
that's amazing.
I think it was the old Egyptian theater, and they had brought in props from Aliens.
Yeah.
And it was out in the lobby. I was there for that. That's why I was like all about this movie.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I saw the film, loved it, saw it again. And then years later, it came out on Laserdisc. And James Cameron was a huge proponent of Laserdisc technology. So it came as a sort of thick box.
Right.
And it had like one, two, I think like four discs on it, plus some making of stuff. And it was the definitive version of the film. And I thought, well, what does that mean? I mean, I'll buy it. So I bought it, put it in, and it was kind of a revelation because suddenly it really is exactly what we're talking about. It was truly a love story. You know, she had lost her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big payoffs at the end of the film is she actually grabs Ripley at the end and says, "Mommy."
Right. I was like, did she just call her mommy? He's like, I think so.
She does. Now, yeah. In the theatrical cut, it happens, and you go, well, okay, yeah, that makes sense. She lost her parents, yeah, which we never see, and there's the whole thing. Well, in the director's cut, we see her pre, you know, alien infestation,
mm-hmm,
with her parents and her young
her brother.
Brother, I was going to say son.
It was actually her real brother in real life.
Is that so?
Yeah.
Okay. And so, yeah, I mean, when we have all that information, plus some additional information, plus the fact that Hicks clearly does like her, and
yeah,
she likes, mm-hmm, him, by the end we have this sort of family unit where Hicks is alive. You know, she has a daughter.
Yep.
They even have this sort of like surrogate half, you know, split open uncle.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yes, absolutely.
And they're setting off into the universe. And it all gets fucked in the third film, which I think is a terrible movie, but that's another story.
Yeah, it's a bad
for
movie.
Many reasons.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, if there's a key thesis statement to this film, it's that it is clearly Cameron's, I think, most passionate film. It may not be his most technically proficient film,
right,
in some respects, but it is someone out to prove something. What came before Aliens? Terminator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's it. Before that, you've got Piranha 2, the, yeah, Spawning. You know?
Yeah.
So
a,
you can't,
a classic,
you wouldn't go, oh, Piranha 2, the Spawning. Man, that guy's going to direct a sequel to Alien.
Right. You know, I'm going to piggyback on that with my thesis statement and say that, to me, this is James Cameron's greatest film. To me. It's the most enjoyable. It hasn't aged. You've got the first ever female action star to get nominated for a leading role.
Yeah.
You know, it's won 5 Oscars. It was nominated for 7, I believe.
Did it win 5? I thought it won two.
Maybe
two, right?
Yes.
Sound,
so,
editing and visual effects, I think?
Yeah. I'm sorry. And it just... And also, I had two statements that I was going to... that I was going to make. But the other one is that if this movie was made 10 years later, it wouldn't be as good as it is now.
Yeah,
it's, and
really
it's because they did models. They built everything by hand. The aliens, the ships. It was all scaled down. There was when they showed a screening of it to a Fox exec, he was like, what are you guys doing? You guys have wasted all this fucking money on these huge ships and these huge buildings? And they're like, no, man, those are models.
Yeah.
And they were talking about how that was like a great moment for all the guys on the crew. Like,
yeah,
we fooled the execs. Like, they didn't even know what was going on.
Right.
So, but for me, you watch this movie, it's 30 years old. It's still scary.
Yeah.
It's still intense. Things look real. The sound's still great. There's very few moments when you're like, okay, the graphics are not up to par. But to have a movie, and he does this with T2 as well, but to have a movie that's 30 years old and still be this good.
Yeah.
It, for me, it's just, this is it. This is Cameron's peak for me.
So, my sentiment is shared at 100%, and my thesis statement would be that James Cameron is the most ageless blockbuster director ever to live.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of what you're talking about. Mm. It's because you watch a film from 1986, a film that cost only $18 million to make.
Right.
And we'll get to that. We'll talk about it in a little bit. Mm. By contrast, within a year of this film, Rambo First Blood Part 2 came out. That movie cost $25 million to make. We did that plug for an episode. You guys want to check that out. JT and Finstock. Great guys. We did that episode on the show, and we sort of marveled at how great the action sequences were for a 30-year-old film.
Right.
It was like, this is amazing for being 30 years old. Not like this is amazing, but just it holds up pretty well. When you figure that this was made within a year of that, and I don't watch this movie and think this holds up pretty well, I literally have to say to myself, okay, picture Prometheus. Think about what Prometheus looks like.
Right.
And then if I think about what Prometheus looks like, I can start to, like, deconstruct what I'm watching.
Right, like ship planning, massive planets,
yeah,
like things like that.
But aside from, unless I actually put my focus on something that's more evolved, I don't even really notice. I'm watching this movie and I'm just, from the opening sequence where you know, the like, whatever that is, the like drone comes in and shines the light across and scans, yeah, right. Scans the body, and you see Ripley, like, just the smoke and the lighting, it's just amazing.
Well, there's a, you know, that's the thing with Cameron, is there's a real economy to how he shoots things. He knows what to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's not any fat, really, in terms of where the camera goes and how he's able to trick, you know, the camera into seeing certain things. Like that opening, I don't know you call it, not hyperbolic chamber, but the...
Stasis chamber. Yeah.
So a sequence like that, you see this long procession of mm-hmm. these, you know, opening chambers. Well, there's only half of those there.
Right. Yeah.
The other half, it's just a mirror.
Yeah, yeah.
That makes it, but there's tons and tons of tricks like that.
$4,200 to make each one of those. And they're like, we can't make 12 of these. This is absurd.
$4,200 to make each one.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
One of my, I think when I said this yesterday when we were watching this, because I hadn't seen this movie in so long. Yeah. I was like, oh my God, the most dated thing in this opening sequence is Sigourney Weaver's hair.
Yeah.
Everything else is perfect. Like, everything else, you could watch it in a movie now, and wow. It would be perfect.
And then the next character you see is Paul Reiser's hair, exactly. And you're like, oh, man,
yep,
this is an 80s movie.
Yeah.
But I know, and I think it was sort of like, you know, it's a retro style.
Yeah.
It was coming back.
Yeah.
Okay. So, wow, so our thesis statements are all very much the same thing, basically, or very similar. It's,
yeah.
James Cameron is just the best.
We'll put our alien egg.
I was going to say, we got to hold up your egg.
I mean, this is, I think of the movies we've done on this show so far, you would only be able to compare it to Terminator 2 and Gladiator in terms of critical acclaim
right.
and its place in history. And I don't think either one is sort of as well loved by all. This is like, maybe. I mean, it's debatable. Those are the three. And this is at least a movie that's on the same level as something that won Best Picture.
Yeah.
And one of the most iconic movies in the history.
Now, we had this conversation about, like, if an action movie, can it win Best Picture? This movie could have won Best Picture.
Yeah.
I really feel like it could.
Totally.
I mean, it wasn't nominated. Didn't win.
Yeah.
Obviously. But I feel like it definitely could have at the time.
Yeah. It's. I mean, we'll talk about what category we all think it fits into but later in the show. But yeah, right. Absolutely. I mean, there's not a whole lot of parts of this movie where you're watching and you're like, well, this is really cool, but it's an action movie.
Right.
It's not really...
No.
No. I mean, I guess maybe Bill Paxton.
Yeah. he is the game over, man. Game
comic
over.
Comic relief. But...
but he's committed to that.
Yeah, he kills it.
100%.
Put her in charge then.
Game over, man. What are we going to do now? Let's talk about fist bump moments. So, guys, if you've never watched this show or you've never listened to this show before, the fist bump moment for us is not just the thing that is coolest. It's really a personal thing. So if you're watching a movie and you're by yourself and something happens, like I drop my pen, and something happens and you literally just have this moment inside where you're like, oh, yes! And you're looking around and you want to just look at one of your friends and have them be like, that's so great. You just have this fist pump. It could be anything. It could be the score. It could be a look that one character gives. Anything. And we like to kind of share that because it just, I don't know, identifies one of the things that we find most...
I mean, that's a very, very important part of an action movie.
100%.
It's that feeling you get inside where you're like, yes! Like, I could do this! I want to be there, you know? And great action movies have this moment to a T.
Ryan and I were talking before we got here about the movie Tombstone, and I was saying how that movie is not just a cult classic, but that movie is, it like defines awesome.
Yeah.
And I was like, our show deals in awesome. That's what this show's about. The more awesome a movie is, the more it qualifies to be on this show. It's not about quality.
No.
Awesome is everything. And I think the fist bump moment is basically the most awesome moment.
Was that like a working title for our show?
All About Awesome?
Yeah.
Fist pump moment, I think, is a porn site.
Fist pump? Yeah. So
kids, go Google it. No.
And let us know your fist pump moment as well, like whatever the best moment is for you. What do you guys got?
Let's start with you, man.
Yeah, let's start with you.
All right. Drink, yeah.
I think my fist pump moment in this film is where Ripley... Spoiler alert. I'm hoping you've seen this movie, guys. Ripley is...
you haven't.
She's just rescued Newt, and she's leaving... And she's going through, like, the alien, the queen's, like, nest with the eggs.
Mm-hmm.
And she kind of stops, and there's this moment of hesitation as she's turning. And it's like an oh my God moment. Like, the wind is kind of blowing.
Yeah.
And then it pulls back, and you see the floor is just lined with these eggs. And she glances over, and she sees the egg being laid from the queen. And as it moves across, and you see the queen.
And her sack in it. Oh.
And the head emerges. Just that whole entire sequence. It's this combination of, like, it's grotesque.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. It's disgusting. It looks incredible.
And you know this is like what you feel is going to be the climax.
It hasn't.
Yeah.
She's got a flamethrower and a kid on her shoulder. And you're like, she's going to have to deal with that.
Right.
And you see all the eggs. You're like, these things are going to hatch any second. She looks over. She sees the two hunter aliens. And they're on the sides.
Don't you like how they back off?
Yeah.
Once they realize that she's got this weapon in front of the queen.
God, it's cool. That's so good. That's my fist bump moment.
Why I went with you first, is because I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah.
And it's so good. But honestly, my fist pump moment, and it gave me chills, was when she comes out in the front loader suit.
Oh, yeah.
And she says, "Get away from her, you bitch." You know, just like that moment of like, yes,
it's about
to happen. Two queens of the movie are going to go head to head right now.
Yeah.
And you know she's going to win.
Yeah.
But how?
And, right?
You're just, because the dude just got ripped apart. Everything seems like it's just going down.
Yeah.
She's hiding in the back. She's about to get the girl. And then the door opens. The line's delivered. And you're just, I got chills. I got chills.
That's which is the definition of a fist bump.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously that scene. And if you, I'm older than you guys. So seeing it in a theater for the first time.
I envy you.
It was electric. It was just, I don't even know if we heard anything after that moment. It was just this, like, oh my God. And you could tell it was a practical effect. This woman is in this practical power loader effect.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Going, well, that's real. I mean, what? And then the queen alien coming in, and it's obviously real, and they're interacting. So that moment, and everyone's literally, I think,
cheering. Yeah.
Aliens is a tough film to say what's the fist pump, because there are so many them.
It's right. Incredible.
I'll tell you another moment in the film that I remember in the theater, when Paul Reiser goes, "This is an emotional moment for all of us," and it's the moment where she has just taken over the APU, and she's driven it through the wall of alien stuff and rescued the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's just like screaming at that moment because it's an emotional moment for the entire audience.
Yeah.
And you look at it and you go, was Cameron that much of a genius that he could figure out that the audience would be screaming? And there's beats in the film throughout that seem to be a call and response. And that is such a interesting experience to feel like. It's something that Tony Scott was really good at doing.
Yeah.
It's something Cameron's a genius at doing. He somehow just knows it. And other people, like Spielberg, obviously really good at that. But yeah, those would be two moments that I feel are
I love obvious. That. This is just a fun trivia fact. So the set design guys, they decided to mess with Sigourney Weaver in this. And in the front-loading suit, she's got a guy behind her.
Power loader.
Power loader, excuse me.
Front-loading suit.
I know.
I'm wearing a front-loading suit.
His name's John, and he's the guy that's moving the mechanism behind her. And they put a little like inflatable balloon in between him and her. And they shot this scene for like 2 or 3 hours, she was saying. And the whole time, she thought the dude behind her was aroused. Because they kept blowing it up at certain moments. She'd feel it. She'd be like, what the fuck is going on back there? Johnny's like, what do you mean? He's like, I don't know what you're talking about. And finally, after like 2 hours, they finally tell her what's going on. So it's hilarious that in that moment of how intense she looks and everything that's going on, the whole time she's like, what is happening to me right now?
Being harassed
by this guy.
It's also amazing that suit is... And it's just, once again, it's like we watched Edge of Tomorrow recently on the show, and those are these incredible exosuits, and they look amazing. But I mean, they're people in giant suits. I mean, this is like a huge. There's two people in there.
Yeah, you have to have two
it's
people.
Just so
too
cool.
much.
Everything about this movie in regards to what Cameron did and how
like
he
technically
is like probably the most fascinating part.
And absolutely.
When we get to production notes, we can talk about some of that stuff and just share some of the stories. But I kind of want to get us into star profiles here before we talk about it. So I would say the two stars of the film are Sigourney Weaver and Michael Biehn, Hicks and Ripley. I mean, unless you say the aliens are a star, but we're not going to be able to break down their careers. So let's
what
talk.
What movie was the alien in before this?
But, there was another from 1979.
Well, the Queen had a talk
this
show.
This is a sequel.
Oh,
there's
really?
An S. There's an S.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. That was Queen Latifah.
So Sigourney Weaver. Three previous films, Ghostbusters, 1984, Deal of the Century, 1983, and The Year of Living Dangerously, 1982. Peter Weir, good movie. Never seen Deal of the Century, and Ghostbusters is a classic.
She's on her way up.
Yeah. I mean, I guess... Ryan, like, do you like? Obviously, we regard Alien from 1979 in a very historical, like, appreciative way, and it's a great movie. But it's a piece of history for me because it's 10 years before I was born, almost.
Yeah.
What was it like for you when Aliens came out? Like, how many times had you seen Alien? How much of a cultural phenomenon was that film?
Alien was a cultural phenomenon. Alien redefined the way we see aliens in movies. And that is a bold statement, but it's absolutely true. If you look at movies prior to Alien, and you look at the aesthetic of science fiction movies prior to Alien, it's very different. And Alien changed the way we look at the future in many respects. A lot of the people that worked on Star Wars, you know, were ported over to work on Alien, and so there's that lived-in, aesthetic, which was really, really key to the Nostromo and the refineries floating through space and all that stuff. But it, in that sense, a lot of that visual heavy lifting was ported over into Aliens. So there's that whole element of it. And of course, Cameron put his mark on it. He changed the aesthetic of the Alien, taking the dome off and
right. And
doing certain things to give it its own look. And
yeah,
I would say that the Alien eggs are far more believable in Alien. They're more organic, and in Aliens they become a little more. Look like Top Ramen was thrown in there instead of like the slimy element to it. You'll know what I'm talking about if you've seen the film a few times. But Alien itself was a watermark.
So with Sigourney Weaver, talking about her career and where she was, obviously, I mean, the only reason I know you're living dangerously is because I watched Peter Weir movies because my dad loved him so much.
Right.
But Deal of the Century is a movie that, at 83, I just don't know anything about.
Bill Friedkin directed it. It was supposed to be a comedy. He directed The Exorcist.
Yep.
You don't think of Bill Friedkin necessarily as the guy that would be directing a comedy.
Right.
Chevy Chase.
Yeah.
Because she's in these movies, like rom-coms and like heist movies and Ghostbusters and stuff. Right before this, it seems like she's on her way up as a star after Alien.
Yeah, agreed. So, because I guess what I mean is, when we look at the titles, it's clear to us like she's on. I guess how iconic of an actress was she because of Alien? So when Aliens came out, would you say she was an absolute A-lister, or would you say she was sort of somebody who was still she hadn't gotten an Academy Award nomination yet?
She was moving up, but I think Sigourney Weaver, and I love Sigourney Weaver, she's a tough actor to necessarily pigeonhole.
Right.
If you look at her in something like Alien, the whole point of that film is that you don't necessarily know what character is going to survive. It's 10 little Indians in space, so you're like, she emerges as sort of the survivor and the strong character. But if you watch that film, hopefully sort of, open to it, you don't see her as being the hero of that film at all.
In fact, first one.
Yeah.
She's a survivor.
It's a big hit. She's a survivor, absolutely. The film is a big hit. And they're like, oh, let's cast her in other things. Not until we get into, I think, Aliens, really.
Yeah.
Put her in that place.
In the A-list, yeah.
And unfortunately, I don't know the chronology here, but I think after Aliens, wasn't it... I know Ghostbusters came along, but after Ghostbusters or before that, wasn't it the film where she played Gorillas in the Mist? Who's the character in that?
Not sure.
But anyway, that was going to like cement her as being like an A-list.
Well, I know Witches of Eastwick is a few years later as well.
Well, she wasn't in that.
That's not her?
No.
Cher, Winona Ryder, and...
Cher was in that, Susan Sarandon and Michelle Pfeiffer.
Okay, I'm way off.
Yeah.
Excellent. Let's move on to Michael Biehn.
Half Moon Street, Girls in the Mist, Working Girl, and Ghostbusters 2, and then Alien 3.
Okay.
That was her next. That was her chronology.
Sorry, what was the chronology?
Excuse me. It was Half Moon Street, Gorillas in the Mist, Working Girl, and then Ghostbusters 2, and then the third
Alien.
Okay,
so Gorillas in the Mist was the one where I think she really, actually, it was sort of built for her.
Yeah.
Yeah, she did a great job. The film wasn't super well received, but it was a really good film.
Not a movie I've ever seen.
And we get into Michael Biehn, which is interesting because he wasn't even cast in this movie originally.
Oh, really?
No, they had James Remar as as his role, and
was fired, right?
And he was yeah. It was they separated due to artistic differences, but he had a drug problem. That's he got fired. Cameron fired him for it.
Boy,
Cameron doesn't deal with that.
It's getting real on Popcorn
Talk. That's right.
I'm just calling you out, man.
There's actually a scene. When they're leaving the initial attack from the aliens.
Yeah,
the Marines are leaving.
Yeah, we are leaving. There's a scene that they were going to have to reshoot the whole thing because it's Remar in it, but they got just enough of the back of Michael Biehn's character.
Yeah.
To where in the film, it's actually James Remar. It's him.
Oh.
But it's just the back of him.
I didn't know
it
that.
It looks the exact same. And then they add in Michael Biehn. They shoot the scenes around it. But yeah, there's that initial them leaving scene that it's not Biehn.
One of the stories about that scene that I liked so much that I was watching a documentary and they were talking about it is that as the acid is burning and they're trying to like light different parts of the APC on fire, they're all sort of looking around and it's Pack that he's telling the story,
yeah.
And he's like, I look over at Jeanette, who plays Vasquez.
Mm-hmm.
And she looks at him and there's like this chemical smoke coming up from the flames because there's plastic burning inside this vehicle.
Right.
She looks at me, she's like, I can't breathe. And Paxton's like, I remember having this great moment. He's like, God, that is such an actorly thing to do. Great improv to do. And then he takes a breath in and he's like, I can't, she's not faking it. And they all just like fall to the ground. None of them can breathe. So they had to clear out the APC, send them to lunch. They come back to shoot it after lunch again. The exact same thing happens again. So then apparently they ripped the roof off and they reshot it again without the roof on it to be able to pull the scene off.
It was hilarious. I thought, that's some good improvising.
Which is even funnier with Bill Paxton. Like, all the interview stuff that you watch with him, like, it's like it goes to Sigourney first and she's like, you know, I was really a gun control advocate. She's I didn't like that there were so many guns with them. I didn't want to carry guns. And then it goes to him. He's like,
quick cut.
He's like, shooting the guns is my favorite part of the movie. Yeah. I've shot a lot of guns. It's great. Like, it's just awesome.
He's fucking stoked.
Yeah, it just killed me. So Michael Biehn, you know, something we were talking about a little was like, Biehn is one of these guys who, you know, if you look at some of the movies in his career, you have Terminator 1, you have Aliens, you have Commander Anderson in The Rock, you have Johnny Ringo in Tombstone. Yeah. Like, movies that I absolutely love.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about Michael Biehn is, he's not really built to be star 1A. He's like,
no.
He's built to be star 1B or like 2A. Like, he's, and even in this movie, it's perfect that he's the male lead, but he's actually upstaged by the machismo of a woman.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's correct. It fits his character. And so I think it's really funny when you look at this, like, mm-hmm. Seen the Fan, never seen Lords of Discipline, Terminator, every role we just mentioned, Johnny Ringo, he's second.
Yeah.
You know, in his Commander Anderson, The Rock.
You know, he's way down there, but he's
a hired gun, right?
Yeah.
This movie, he's taking orders from somebody, and then essentially he's taking orders from Ripley.
There's something about him that gives him a leading star's presence,
yeah,
but you don't want to see just him do it.
Like him headlining a movie, like an action movie, it would never have worked.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of like that feeling, and this is kind of a stretch for our genre, but it was like that feeling you got with John C. Reilly.
Yeah.
You've seen him all these movies as a great secondary character, but then all of a sudden he did Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, and you're like, okay, he can actually carry a whole movie on his own.
It was great.
But I'm just saying, like, it's one of those guys where you don't think that they have it in him to be delete 90 minutes of just him.
Right.
And they cast him perfectly in this.
Yeah, he definitely can thank James Cameron for an awesome career.
Yeah.
I
would say so.
Yeah, we were talking about that on the way over to the set. I think that Michael Biehn's best performance was in Tombstone.
Johnny Ringo, yeah.
Absolutely.
So great.
Yeah, and I like him. I like him in everything. But I think that he really, truly is someone who brings a specific thing to a film.
He's a role-filling guy.
Yeah.
You know?
100%.
I'm trying to say it in a nice way. I mean,
No, totally. I mean, look,
we love you, Michael Biehn. If you were to come on the show, we would be elated.
Yeah,
like ecstatic. Like, love Michael Biehn.
Have
to
you
death.
All seen The Fan? 1981.
Yeah,
The Fan.
100%.
You've seen The Fan.
I saw it. My dad made
it's
me.
One
watch
of my
it.
Camp classic movies.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, yes,
yeah. Love it.
It's good.
I have no idea what the film is about. It's
but I
it's,
love
it's,
it.
It seems like it was made by a bunch of gay theater queens who said, "Let's make a horror film."
I can tell you very little about The Fan. There was a stretch of movies that when I was like getting into the AFI Top 100, so
Lauren
I was like 12.
Bacall. It's Lauren Bacall. She's the lead in a slasher movie, and she's going to resurrect her career by doing this musical. And this young guy, Michael Biehn, is obsessed with her sexually, and he keeps writing her fan letters, and they become increasingly erotic, and eventually he tries to kill her by killing people around him, and he stages his death by going to a gay bar and killing someone who looks like him. Oh, it's a
sounds great.
And it's
sounds
and like it's interspersed for the audience. Maybe I haven't seen this movie. Maybe I'm mixing this up.
I think maybe you are. And it's interspersed with all sorts of great musical numbers. And I say great in quotes. It's a fascinating film.
We're just going to turn off the show and go watch that.
If you guys want to watch The Fan, come back. So let's talk a little bit about who made the movie, directors, producers.
We're going to skimp on this slightly because we got other things we got to get to.
We have a lot we want to talk about, and I mean, if any of you guys watched the Terminator 2 episode, which Some of you did, and if you haven't, you should.
Cause I watched it. It was awesome.
Because he's
a
great.
Oh, no, I didn't. I was actually on it. Right.
We did a lot of the same research, and it's a lot of the same people in the same place in their careers now as they were 10 weeks ago. So
that's right.
Cameron, obviously, is basically a genius when it comes to blockbusters and action movies. I'm dropping my pen again.
I'm not giving you my pen this week.
It's okay. So Cameron, you know, he studied physics, majored in physics at California State University. Drove a truck to support a screenwriting ambition, and then basically after working on Roger Corman films, he ended up directing Terminator in 84, had a giant, huge success from that, and now has directed two of the three highest-grossing films of all time.
Right, but I mean, by the time this movie was released, he had written... It's tough to say that he'd written Rambo First Blood Part 2, because he did, and then Sylvester Stallone went in and redoctored it and completely changed a lot of it.
Yeah.
But he'd written Terminator, and he'd been working on The Abyss, and he's writing this.
Yeah.
Like, this guy... is incredible. And then he goes on to do T2 immediately afterwards.
Mm-hmm. We were talking a little bit about the similar... And I mentioned Rambo First Blood Part 2 once already, but the similarities between First Blood and Alien, and then Aliens and First Blood Part 2...
Like the tone, the tonality. Yeah.
And the shift in tone between the first and the second film, it's very interesting. Both of the second films are big-budget action movies made in, I think, 85 and 86, or within a year or two of each other.
Yeah.
And both of the first films are these much more, like, character-driven, much more dramatic sort of...
heavy, serious...
Yeah, I mean, First Blood is a pretty serious movie. I mean, Brian Dennehy is quite good in it. Like, it's, you know, it's post-traumatic stress. Like, Rambo... Didn't you tell me that in the original cut he kills himself at the end of First Blood?
Yeah, and actually, they filmed that, his suicide. So we wouldn't, you know, everything would have been a prequel, I guess, had, you know, been a hit otherwise. But yeah, test screenings were like, oh God, why did he kill himself?
It's really dark.
Yeah.
So it's interesting when you look at Cameron's
career.
Well,
I think that's how it ends in the book, too. I mean, in First Blood, he commits suicide.
Yeah, so I've never read it. Even knowing that Cameron drew inspiration for Aliens from the Vietnam War.
Yeah, I mean, that's genius.
Yeah, and he wanted a situation where he was going to put a team of soldiers that were better equipped than the opposition in an unfamiliar territory where their weapons and their superior firepower would be useless against, you know, these unfamiliar opponents.
Right, I mean, they're sitting there with these trackers, and they're on top of us. Where are they? Well, this isn't working. No, they're above you. You know, it's the exact same feel, and I think that was a really cool thing, especially for when this movie had come out. Everyone was very familiar with what was going on, what had happened, you know, and this type of thing, I think it subliminally hit home. I don't think a lot of people understood it, but they loved it for some reason.
For Aliens?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, if you're under a certain age, that completely went over your head.
Right.
And if you look at, it went over my head, I mean, but then you look at the time frame, and you're like, oh, but, you know, for people that were in their 20s and 30s and 40s, that really hit home.
Yeah.
But, you know the concept you're describing is a trope now. I mean, if you look at Predator, same thing, superior firepower, but they can't deal with this.
Yeah.
This, you know, thing which has now become indigenous to this jungle, even though it's from a different planet, you know, and things like that. And all that stuff is, I think... you know, all those metaphors are very similar to, you know, post 9/11, you know, iconography. If you look at after, you know, September 11th, movies from that point forward, action films, not horror films, but, you know, big budget films that had destruction in it, it's all informed by the things we saw post 9/11. So in that sense, the Vietnam War was such a huge and divisive sort of, you know, event that it was going to creep into pop culture in some way, form or fashion. And it has. And it's, you know, you can make a direct comparison to say, you know, the first Godzilla film, you know, the Japanese government did not want, forbid any kind of media to discuss the war or anything like that. So they had to find metaphors to discuss, you know, Hiroshima and things like that. And that's where Godzilla was born out of.
Sure.
So from that respect, that's how we get these sorts of interesting subtextual things and stories like this. And I think that also gives them legs when you've got someone really smart like Cameron that can find ways to put that in there. It's just another element that gives it more life the more times you watch it.
Well, and sci-fi fantasy is such an escape. That's the point. So it's very interesting, as you said, a director smart enough. I mean, Sigourney Weaver in an interview says she hates guns. She thinks Cameron hates guns too.
Right.
But he's fascinated by them in a way she's not.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, this is an
until
escapist.
Until she shot them. Yeah. Like, this is kind of awesome.
The flamethrower is pretty cool. Yeah.
But if it's reflective of reality in a way, I mean, it makes it that much more intelligent, sure. Which is why it resonates.
Yeah.
What was so cool about him writing this is David Giller and Walter Hill over at Fox, they had... they've been in a rights battle because the ownership, I believe, at Fox changed during Alien and Aliens. Once they'd won the rights, they were trying to find someone to write Alien 2. And Giller's like, well, what about... He'd seen the Terminator script. Mm-hmm. He's like, well, what about this guy? They're like, well, who is this guy?
Right.
Which is hilarious.
He worked on Piranha.
Who's James Cameron?
Yeah.
So they're like, who is this guy? You know, I don't really want anything to do with him. And then, so they're like, okay, so we kind of want you to write this second movie. What do you think about it? So in 4 days... After 4 days, he'd written 45 pages.
Yeah, treatment, right?
Yeah. And, the execs were like, oh, okay, I think this is going to be great. But they were like, but he's shooting Terminator.
Yeah.
We want this to come out. You know, we don't have enough time, essentially. All of a sudden, a scheduling conflict comes up with Arnold and Conan the Barbarian, where he's going to be on a 90-day hiatus. So Cameron goes and writes 95 pages over these, like, next few weeks, months, and gives it to the execs. And they're like, all right, we don't normally do this. We're going to wait for you to finish. So that we can have you come on and direct this movie and write it. Just immediately just paving the way for this massive career that he has.
Mm-hmm. What do you think would have happened if Ridley Scott had done Aliens and Cameron had done Rambo First Blood Part 2? What do we think those movies would look like?
I'm so glad that didn't happen.
Right? But I mean, it's not beyond, if you think about like the way things happened at the time, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that could have happened.
I think the DNA of Rambo, I think the DNA of Cameron is still very present in Rambo First Blood Part 2. Everything from the timed explosive arrows you know, sort of the big set piece, and then there's a bigger set piece coming. Although I think that you put Cameron and Stallone in a room together, and you're going to have a big cockfight.
Yeah,
exactly.
And
true.
So I don't know what kind of film you'd end up with, frankly. But I can pretty much assure you that if Ridley Scott directed Aliens, it probably wouldn't be the film it is.
No.
I hate to say that, because, I mean, I really like Ridley Scott.
Oh, he's great.
But I look at Ridley Scott and go, yeah, I mean, he's great, but I don't think he's a genius.
Question of the day, guys.
I know,
who is the greater action movie... I'm sorry, the greater science fiction visionary, Ridley Scott or James Cameron?
James Cameron.
Yeah, and that's what I said last week when we talked about Gladiator and me saying that Gladiator was Ridley Scott's best movie. I think that these movies that James Cameron did in the beginning of his career, Terminator, this, The Abyss, and Terminator 2, and then he went on to do Avatar, not only does he...
And revolutionized
and Titanic, but we're talking sci-fi.
Okay, yeah.
Not only did he revolutionize the way that you shot these movies with introducing real 3D and Avatar and obviously all the models and everything he did for these movies, the dude is... Ridley Scott paved it in a different way.
Yeah.
He's more revolutionary. James Cameron is. Ridley Scott kind of built a genre, whereas James Cameron, I feel like, perfected it.
I would say Ridley Scott was revolutionary in a lot of things. And I would say certainly with Alien, we wouldn't have aliens. And we certainly wouldn't have that look or that, well, let's just say that aesthetic. Cameron takes tone and masters it in a way that I think is just unbelievably remarkable. And the fact that he's willing to really kind of put everything on the line for these films.
Yeah.
He really seems to sweat blood when
the
he
passion involved. Oh, yeah. I mean, Bean in one of the interviews is saying, and he corrects himself, it's interesting, he says, when Cameron was doing this movie, he was really in his prime as a filmmaker. He said, well, you know, this is an 03
interview. He's still in his prime.
He says he's still in his prime, but it's like, I think there's a real feeling that, like you said, there's a blood, sweat, and tears passion.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, one of the first things Andrew and I said when we were watching Aliens, I was like, good Lord, look at the space, look at the set design, just every little detail, just the way the whole place feels, the lighting, everything. And he's so particular about what he wants his movie to look like.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, the thing is, like, did you move that arm? He's like, I didn't tell you to move that arm.
Right.
You know? It's just, it's like barely even in the shot for like half a second. Like, the dude, everything needs to be the exact way he wants it.
Well, but here's the thing. It's like, When you're directing a film, and I have some experience this now, you will fight with your producers on these sorts of things. You will say, well, this is the way I want it. And look, I'm not saying that the director's always right or the producer's always wrong, because that's not the case. But you you know, if you listen to interviews with people or you know people that have worked with James Cameron, he is willing to say, look, it is my way,
yeah.
period. You want to fight me on this? We will fight. We will shut the production down and we will fight on this.
I mean, there was numerous people fired throughout this movie.
Dick Bush, director of photography, was
absolutely
replaced.
Yeah, right. I mean, it was one of the set design guys, and one of the editors was so worried about losing his job, he stayed up for like 2 days straight and locked himself in a room and reshot the final scene to be like, I want to be here.
James Horner.
And let me tell you.
Yeah,
James Horner. Well, they ended their relationship after Aliens.
But he got an Academy Award nomination for score that he wrote in 4 days. I mean, it's because, like...
But I used to be really, really... there was a part of me that said, well, yeah, Cameron, but I don't think I'd want to, you know, be his buddy.
Yeah.
I still wouldn't want to be his buddy, but I don't think he wants any buddies. I think he wants to make his movies. And so, you know, I look at it now and go, look, people that are that opinionated and can show it, get out of their way.
Yeah,
let them do what they're going to do.
It's funny that you talked about the producer, because next we're going to be talking about the producer, which is Gail Ann Hurd, who ended up marrying Cameron throughout the filming of this, who the whole time, and, you know, she's worked on Walking Dead, all the Terminators, Armageddon, The Abyss. She...
A really good vampire film called Near Dark.
The one, is that the 80s one with, what's this,
with Bill Paxton? Paxton?
Yeah, with Bill Paxton,
And Jeanette...
And it's directed, if I'm not mistaken, by Kathryn Bigelow.
I believe so.
Who,
Who interesting.
Also married
another. Look at that.
So
I don't know what this means, but
she constantly was getting ragged on by everyone around her for you're only here because you're James Cameron's girlfriend. You're James Cameron's wife. You don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, contrary.
But you go through and you watch, and obviously, the things we just mentioned that she worked on, you go through and you watch these making of videos. She's right there. She's on the same level as Cameron.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's just as passionate, and everything that he says or that she executes is done with this incredible amount of thought. Mm-hmm. And I mean, look at the movie.
Yeah, she was great. And she was with him.
And look at her career.
Yeah.
I mean,
she straight up fired people, too. She's like, you don't want to do this? You're gone. We'll replace you. And she would do it.
Yeah, well, the British crew did have some issues with...
Oh, yeah. They hated working for him. Yeah. First of all, they thought he was an idiot.
Yeah. And they needed to take tea breaks.
They had to take tea breaks. And, but the one thing that Cameron did that was cool is he would show them dailies at the end of every day, the whole crew.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like a rally cry for them every night to be like, all right, well... Shit, it looks that good. Let's stay up all night and make the next day look that good.
Yeah.
You know? So he kind of had to, like, he's like dropping cookies in front of a mouse, just like get it closer and closer and closer.
One of the things.
Smart.
So we'll talk about this in just 1 second, but if you look at this movie and you start to try to imagine, okay, in 1986, to get this to look the way that it looks and to do some of the things they did, if you don't know, it's hard to imagine. So a great example is that the Queen Alien, and we have a making of video we're going to queue up here. We can just sort of show what we talk about this.
Yeah.
It's a 14-foot puppet, and it's operated most of the time by 14 or 15 people.
Sometimes even 16, they said, was the maximum number, which is...
Crazy. And there's two people inside this puppet.
Yeah, back to back.
And on top of that, it doesn't... None of what you see has any like digital removal of cables or wires.
No.
It's just Cameron saying, okay, look, economy of shot. We need to show this, that, and the other. So we're going to shoot it like this. Mm-hmm. We're going to shoot it behind this, coming around this corner. And while everybody was like, this is going to be too expensive. You're going to go over budget. We're going to run out of time. I mean, one of the original producer or the original DP, who we said here, Dick Bush, he was insisting on lighting the nest brightly lit.
Light, he wanted,
And Cameron's, no, I'm not doing that. And he's like, you're just going to take too much time. He said, no, we're just going to shoot it the way we want to shoot it, and this is going to work. And as you can see, I mean, this is like the process that they were going through to construct something. I mean, the face huggers are another one that it was – they're trying to figure out a way with these puppets.
Well, give it up to Stan Winston's group too. I mean, they really
– Yeah. Winston's incredible. They've got all these different puppets that do all these different things. And when they want the skittering across the floor, you know, one of those shots where Ripley's on the ground and the facehugger jumps up on the table.
Reversed, right?
And flies towards the camera. Yeah, it's shot in three pieces.
Yeah, it's skittering across the floor.
Operated by a bunch of people and cables and wires. It's a puppet.
And then they set it up on the actual piece.
Reverse photography to jump.
Pull it back.
And then the same deal with a third shot going towards the camera. And you watch it and it doesn't even look the least... Like, for one of the things one of the guys in the crew says is, look... Well, you didn't think about this, James.
Yeah, they would come up and like wag their finger. They were so smart.
Yeah, it's the sprinklers are going in the room when this is happening, so there's going to be water coming down, and if you reverse it, you're going to see it. He said, no, it's just going to be a texture on the ground.
Yeah.
You won't notice the difference because it doesn't matter. It's the same look, and he was absolutely right.
Yeah, and that was kind of that moment where everyone realized that like all right, we need to just shut up and do what this guy wants, because he's thought about it. Yeah. He's already imagined every way, like anything he imagines, he's already figured out a way to execute it.
Absolutely.
So we're just going to shut our mouths, and we don't want to get fired like Bush, you know?
But that goes back to my point, which is sometimes people will not share your vision. Mm-hmm. And you either have to say, well, we hired the guy to do it, let's let him do what he's going to do.
So we have this video we're going to show right now. We'll kind of chat over it, but you can just see the development of the Queen as we talk about this next part. Just the sort of like wrapping of plastic garbage bags and the original mock-up and
they had like a room full of puppeteers operating each individual limb, and it'd be like, move it up and down, no, slower, move it all the way up and then partially down and up, and like he would sit there and direct every limb for every puppeteer.
This is what I was talking about with economy of shots too, because he knew what to shoot.
You know,
it can look like shit from over here, but we don't care what it looks like from over there.
Yeah, one of the stories that's so cool about that. And
I've seen this video. This is terrific stuff. This is like the
original.
You know, they're doing some.
But the economy of shot. You talk about this is one of the stories that I thought was so cool. When Bishop gets ripped in half,
loved it.
So they had like I think like some sort of like water soaked latex, a tube that was running up his shirt with a wire attached to it, and actually behind him was the Queen puppet. But in the shot, you don't see it. Mm-hmm. And what happens is they pull the wire through his shirt, and the wire then extends the latex, so it looks like the alien blade because it goes at a high speed. Mm-hmm. They pull back, and the alien's behind him, and they've got the fake tail jammed into his back, and he's got milk and yogurt mixed up in his mouth, and he starts vomiting all over himself. And it's like, you're trying to conceptualize that.
Well, when they pull the thing out of him, it goes into his suit.
Yeah.
You know, it goes down his leg, which you don't see because it happens so quickly.
Yeah.
It's just, it's genius. Everything that they do is genius in this film. And this is, again, 30 years old, and it's all real effects.
So crazy. And it looks amazing still.
It still does.
Yeah, I didn't really think that it'd age. So, anyway, let's talk about $18.5 million budget and this movie was made for nothing.
Yeah, this movie is 30 years old. $18.5 million might sound like a lot. It wasn't then. Still,
5 years later, 5 years later, he was like, "Give me $100 million. I'm making Terminator 2."
Yeah,
they're like, "All right, you can do it.
You can do it. Sure, whatever."
Well, if I'm not mistaken, isn't this a lower budget than the first Alien? What didn't Alien cost more?
That I don't know, but I do know that Rambo cost 25. Right. I can tell you that much.
Well, we have these little mini computers. Yeah. You could look it up.
You talk
and see
about
it.
Numbers. I'll figure this out real quick. Yeah.
So it opens
the way you look at it. $18 million, even in adjusted dollars. I mean, it's not a micro budget film at all. It's a low budget movie,
right?
So they were giving him enough rope to hang themselves, essentially.
Yeah,
and of course,
and it stayed under budget and finished on time.
So it was $11 million budget in '79 for Alien.
But I wonder what that is in adjusted.
It's got to be very, very close.
Yeah.
So this movie opened in July.
Yeah, you know? And the movie, we have a little chart here. We'll show of
and Vamp, which was going to be the big hit of the year.
Yeah, we have the opening weekend, July 18th, and the movies that it opened against.
Not this one, but the other graphic.
Yeah, the other graphic. So we have the opening weekend, and it's pretty funny to think that.
No, that's really Scott.
That's really Scott.
There we go.
There we perfect. Go. Karate Kid 2.
Well,
in theaters already.
Yeah.
You have Vamp and Pirates are the openers that weekend. Mm-hmm. I looked up both these movies. Not ashamed to say I had never heard of either one of them. Pirates was directed by Roman Polanski, starring him. Who did I say was in that movie?
Walter Matthau.
Yeah.
And Natasha Kinski.
Yes. And then Vamp, which I believe was film about a bar that is run by vampires. And it's a comedy.
Oh, wow. That's genius.
Grace Jones.
Yeah, okay.
Was the Vamp.
Did it get gross $2,000? Is that what it says?
$2 million?
That weekend.
$2 million. Okay,
$2,000.
I was like, "Are you serious?"
So that's pretty crazy. That in July 18th, Aliens is opening against Vamp and Pirates.
Right. I mean, there's other big, huge movies in there, as you can see if you look down the list: Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Top Gun, Karate Kid 2. But that's what you want to open your movie Vamp against is Aliens, directed by James Cameron.
Yeah, well, who was not? I mean,
Terminator had been out in America.
Well, if you look at these numbers now, let's see how long had Ruthless or Karate Kid been in theaters? 2 weeks?
Looks like it.
So Karate Kid Part 2 was probably going to be considered the big hit of the summer.
Absolutely.
Looks like it was his fifth. This is sixth week.
I'm sorry, I can't see. So
very blind.
And Top Gun
still huge.
Still huge.
It's been in theaters for 10 weeks. It's made another $4 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it is interesting to see that this, you know, $10 million opening weekend, which on an $18 million budget, it's a great start.
Yeah,
hey, the
bad.
Word of mouth on Aliens was, I mean, this is before Twitter. This is before Facebook. This is before anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I can
the
just
word
imagine.
Of mouth was enormous. Yeah. For good reason.
So $131 million total, definitely, you know, propelled Cameron into superstardom as a director.
Mm-hmm.
Gave him the rope to do pretty much whatever he wanted. I would mm-hmm. say T2 was definitely the... T2 was the you can absolutely do whatever you want moment.
Right.
But this mm-hmm. movie was pretty damn close.
You don't think that was Abyss?
Well, I mean...
Because T2 is a sequel to a very successful first movie.
Yeah, maybe
Abyss
so.
Is kind of like, you write, you direct, you do everything you want, here's all this money.
Yeah, I would know, other than the numbers on Abyss, I don't know them.
Well, Abyss was a disappointment.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know what the revisionist history is now, but when the Abyss came out, you know, a lot of people walked out of that film going, "Well, there's a lot of cool stuff in it, but it wasn't the juggernaut that I think Cameron wanted it to be."
Yeah.
And that's another film where there are certain little key elements of it that were cut from the theatrical cut, which is a little bit strange.
Right.
I don't know if you've seen...
No, I've never seen the director's cut.
The director's cut, okay.
Oh, yeah, what, are we talking The Abyss?
Yeah.
The Abyss. No, I have not seen it.
You know, I think it would be not such a good idea to maybe even spoil that. So if you get a chance to anyone to watch the director's cut of The Abyss next to the theatrical cut, you'll see what I'm talking about. There's some...
Right.
Couple of key moments that are kind of perplexing in the fact they were cut from the theatrical cut.
Interesting.
So we got our engineer back there looking up the numbers on The Abyss, which it made...
So there you go. Total gross, $54
million. Yeah. Domestic, $54 million.
What has it got down? What's the total there, John?
Yeah, I'm blind.
I really have the worst vision, guys. But it wasn't successful. But I think we can just chalk it up to that. If it made $54 million domestic, it was made later on. He's already made T2 and this movie. It wasn't there.
But the Abyss was really a real, you know, a real hiccup.
Yeah.
For him.
Mm-hmm. Well, is The Abyss before or after? What year is Abyss?
After T2.
It is.
After,
yeah. Okay, it's after.
It's right afterwards.
It does look like it made a good chunk worldwide, though.
What does it say?
It made $90 million worldwide, $54 million domestic.
Yeah, so...
Still.
That's
a disappointment
big step
coming
back
off of,
from these previous
yeah.
two movies.
I mean, on a follow-up to a film that made 131 worldwide,
mm-hmm.
A follow-up to T2.
Yeah, which
yeah,
was
131,
yes.
And then T2 made an absurd amount of money.
Or 212. So we have the graphic here for all the Alien movies that came out, and surprisingly, Alien is the number one. I mean,
yeah.
This is adjusted for, you know, today.
For 79,
which
yeah.
is very, which you have to in this big of a franchise. First of all, the whole franchise has made almost $1 billion.
It's crazy.
Which is, that's including the Alien vs. Predators and Alien vs. Predator Requiem and all that. But you look here, the very first Alien movie made $263 million back in 79. Adjusted
yeah,
for now.
78, but yeah.
Or, excuse me, yeah. So unadjustedly, it made $78 million, and you're like, wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
You know, and then you look, and Aliens made almost as much a few years later.
Yep.
And then Prometheus, it makes sense, because Alien 3 was kind of, like you said, it's a bad movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Prometheus wasn't bad, it just wasn't, like, watching Aliens for the first time.
I've heard that there is a, and Ryan, speak to this if you know anything about this, that I've heard that...
Okay.
What?
Just so we know,
Abyss
came
right
out.
Beforehand.
The Abyss came out, and then Terminator 2.
That's what I thought.
I was thinking about this. So, and this is important because when The Abyss came out, one of the things that did come out of The Abyss was
oh, right.
the use of
yeah.
CGI,
Robert Patrick,
in the real proper way. So
yeah.
that water tentacle was the thing that said
became
okay.
T-1000.
Well, we can that became the T-1000
exactly.
That's a real key point.
That paved the way for that movie.
And that also was a big resurrection also for Arnold Schwarzenegger. It was a big, big hit. Because he'd done a few things and done well, but this brought them both back on the map in a huge way.
Right.
T2, yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. So,
get into critical.
That's why
oh,
I'm like
sorry.
Checking my phone here. Sorry.
Yeah, no worries, no worries. It is interesting looking at these numbers and thinking about something I just wanted to talk about just briefly before we move into critical was... If you look at sci-fi movies in the 5 years on either side of this, right? So 1986, and let's say 81 is the year we start this, so it's a good place to start. So you go 81 to 91.
Mm-hmm.
I did a little bit of research yesterday just to see, like, if you look on IMDb, if you look on Tomatoes, if you look at the various sites, what are the highest rated sci-fi movies between 81 and 91? It's very interesting that the two highest rated are T2 and Aliens.
And Aliens, yes.
And then you have like Back to the Future, you have E.T., you have The Thing, you have like Return of the Jedi, you've got Predator. None of these movies, I mean, even Jedi, which is probably of the ones I just named, I guess E.T. is pretty monumental.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're not on the same level, though, in terms of, like, you watch the movies now and you say, T2, Aliens, these are sci-fi movies that have this eternal quality.
Yes.
And those other movies we're talking about, it's like, people sort of like, they're like, yeah, I mean, Jedi, Star Wars, I love Jedi, but it's the worst of those original three.
I think the difference is that those films seem to be artifacts a bit.
They're campy.
Yeah. Oh, I wouldn't call them campy. I mean, but they've
definitely aged.
E.T. aged in a way I don't think anyone expected. Because E.T. for the time
that was... That movie scared the shit out of me as a kid.
Oh, well, and Terminator 1 is the third one, by the way.
Right.
That would be the other that is the best reviewed.
But if you look at E.T., up to a point, it was the most successful film of all time.
Yep.
Right? And a lot of people thought, well, look, that's going to be like, like Wizard of Oz. A lot of people talked about it. Like, that's going to be a classic... all-time perennial, you know, kids film, and it's a mm-hmm. beautiful sort of science fiction film. I said that in quotes because it's, you know,
yeah,
not really. But it really has become kind of an artifact. It's the film doesn't seem to have really resonated through generations, which is interesting. Whereas a movie like Aliens, you know, it felt like it pushed itself slightly ahead of its time. And I think that's one of the things about these types of movies that work.
Yeah.
That's why a film like, say, RoboCop, which is another film I adore.
It's incredibly. It's aged vastly, though.
It has aged, but it was so violent mm-hmm. for its time that a lot of people sort of pushed away from it going, wow, this is too much.
Right. Yeah.
And its satire was, you know, hit its mark with some people. Other people thought, I don't know, is this supposed to be funny?
Mm.
So the film... And I think RoboCop ages very, very well, in spite of some of its visual effects.
Sure.
For that very reason. So I think that can play into this as well. Yeah. I don't know where that rates in terms of Rotten Tomatoes or whatever, but...
Well, speaking of tomatoes, let's breathe through these so we can make sure we get recast and talk about your movie a little bit.
We got IMDb. It's got an 8.4. It's rated 65th on the 250. You know, that alone, just for what this movie is, that's a great start. And then Rotten Tomatoes, I think this is the highest reviewed movie that we've done. All across the board.
98, 93, 94?
Yeah, I mean, all critics 98, top critics 93, and the audience gives it a 94. And I don't think they could be more correct.
Yeah.
There's nothing about this. I mean, the fact that I love scary movies, Ryan directs scary movies, this movie is still scary.
Absolutely.
And it's an action movie. But it's scary. Like, everything we talked about, the facehuggers crawling across the floor, the laying of the eggs, the queen, it's terrifying still. Like, you and I were on the edge of your couch watching the end of this movie.
But it doesn't cheat people that want action.
No,
and it doesn't
cheat
people that want scary. That's one of the really cool things about it. It doesn't seem to, you know, have a problem with either one.
Right. Cameron says he didn't want horror, he wanted terror. Is that what he was going for?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and which is interesting because you go in this and then Gene Siskel was not a fan. He gave it a 2 out of 4. He goes, count me out of the fan club for this one. To me, Aliens is extremely violent, protracted attack on the senses, as surviving space explorer Sigourney Weaver again confronts the spiny slithering creature who killed her buddies in the original film. And then he goes on to say, some people have praised the technical excellence of Aliens. Well, the Eiffel Tower is technically impressive, but I wouldn't want to watch it fall apart on people for 2 hours. Which is just, it's absurd. Like, he complains about, like, this... In the longer review, he complains about how, like, there's this love story between her and the girl that's, like, cheap, and she gets kidnapped, and so you care more. No.
No.
It's not cheap.
We haven't
great.
Even talked about Newt yet, actually. We've talked for 62 minutes. We haven't even mentioned her yet.
She's great. She's so endearing.
She's one of... We've talked about, like, the Dakota Fanning Man on Fire effect, where your character is adorable and a little weird and not, like... She's not, like, cliche cute.
She doesn't overstep her bounds as a child character.
She's not
distracting. I'm going to challenge you guys on this a little bit. I don't agree with Gene Siskel, obviously, but Cameron has no problem with going for the obvious.
Sure.
Never.
He directed True Lies.
Well, I mean, look, you throw a little girl into the mix, which is his invention, you're like, well, there you go.
Right. There's something to happen at some point.
Right. And she lost a daughter, now she gets a new daughter. And, I mean, you go through all of his films and you'll find, like, oh my gosh. I mean, Avatar is very paint-by-numbers in that respect.
Absolutely.
It's Pocahontas mm-hmm. in space.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And without any deviations, except it's just a bigger scope and
right,
it's got science fiction
element. Yeah.
But the fact that he is so assured in what he's doing, and he's sort of daring you to say, "Yeah, yeah, well, fine. It's a basic story, but whatever. I'm gonna put my mark on it." I think maybe he did a bad sandwich when he sat down to watch it, because you know he loves Gene Siskel was famously in love with a lot of movies which are similar to this. So it's just like maybe he had a bad day. Because
Ebert's usually the one that's more against those the big bloody. And Ebert gave this movie a 3 out of 4.
Yeah,
that's and so funny. You
and maybe he'd do
4 out of 4
if he were alive today. But
I can't even imagine. Yeah, I mean, there's a fresh review here from Walter Goodman of the New York Times. It says, "A flaming, flashing, crashing, cracking, blow-em-up show that keeps you popping from your seat despite your better instincts and the basically conventional scare tactics."
But that was a review for The View, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I picked that one out just because I'm like, yeah, it was. I was on the edge of my seat 30 years later. Ah!
Terrifying. Those facehuggers are scary as shit.
Yes, keep that.
Oh my goodness.
It's mine.
Definitely absolutely horrifying. What do you guys think the ultimate scene in this movie is? What is the ultimate action scene? I think we have a video to queue up here of the scene, which I personally, even though it's not the most action-packed scene, I really do think that the scene that I mentioned earlier, where she's walking through the egg nest, and we have a video we can cue of that right now, is pretty amazing.
Yeah,
it's not really action-y in the way that like the fight is action-y or like, do you know what I mean?
I mean, her getting to this point, there's a lot of action. This is like the only time you see Ripley like using a fully automatic machine
gun.
Here's
the top ramen.
Yeah. Because I mean, you could say that the loader versus the queen is the ultimate action.
Right.
I think most people would.
The original attack on the Marines is the ultimate action scene as well.
I would say the second half of the attack on Marines is probably like the most propulsive scene. If you actually, the battle between Ripley and the queen is again beautiful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But if you watch it, it's slow and plodding and exciting. Yep. I mean, when I say slow, I don't mean slow like, oh, it's a slow scene. It's a very intense scene.
Yeah.
But, when she decides to take over, that music cranks up. It's called the piece of music called Feudal Escape, if you want to listen to it on your...
All right.
on iTunes. It's an amazing piece of music. And she takes over the APU, and she drives that thing through the wall. That is very fast. And it's the cuts are really moving at a really, really intense pace.
I think for me, that's the truest action.
That's a pure action scene. That's pure action.
Yeah, it's as you said, it's sort of one of those movies where it's terror, not action. It is an action movie, but the whole movie is sort of, it has this pace that you know that this isn't really an action scene.
No,
but it's the most, to me, it's the most vibrant scene. It makes me feel the most.
Yeah, this moment of her realization of just like, oh my god, where am I?
It's so cool.
Yeah.
Oops, we took a wrong turn.
Yeah.
The exact wrong turn.
Just the look, and then oh god, this scene's crazy.
And we can leave it on while we talk about where Sigourney ranks, because I think it's important. This part of, I mean, these are the people. It's the queen alien.
Yeah.
As the villain. And Sigourney Weaver, Ripley, obviously, is the hero.
Yeah, on the all-time action movie hero-villain list. I mean, I think Ripley, for me, not only because she's basically, in the way that Linda Hamilton is another awesome, awesome female character that would make the list, but she's not the star hero, sort of T2. Yeah. Sigourney is very much the star. I mean, Cameron would joke with her and say Rambo Lita. I mean, I think you have to say she's like, top 15, top 10.
I put her like at 12,
11,
probably.
9, yeah, somewhere right around in that range.
Anywhere from 9 to 12, because she is such a badass. She's the smartest person in the room. She's fearless.
Well, yeah.
She goes into this place. I mean, fearless, yes. Maybe not. But
no, she is. But I would just say to that, see where she starts in this film. She is frightened. She's having nightmares.
Yeah.
She's having
back.
Cold sweats. It's the last thing she wants to do is do what she's doing here.
Right.
And one of the great things, another great thing about Aliens is it's a real journey for this character to go from a place of, I want to be in a tiny space. I don't want to be talking to anyone. Mm-hmm. I lost everything. To, I'm going to confront the greatest fear and everything that this represents, literally and figuratively, and I'm going to take it on, and I'm going to be a badass. It's a complete 180 from where she is at the beginning of the story. And that is something that is really, really key to the success of this character in this film. Because if you look at Rambo, Rambo's a badass in the beginning. He's a badass at the end. This film this is a character who has a really fascinating journey.
She changes.
Which is betrayed in Alien 3, but...
Yeah, she just, hands down, the character arc and what she does and the fighting the queen one-on-one, she's got to be, yeah, 9 to 12 for me.
What do you think, Ryan? Is she top 10 for you on action hero?
I agree with him 100%.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I go, and the queen for me is top 10. I go...
Really?
Because I think there's a couple elements that really make a villain iconic for me. Sometimes it's the lines, sometimes it's how much you hate them, sometimes it's how much you fear them.
Yeah.
And then I think a big one is how visually iconic they are for you, how much they're seared into your memory.
Yeah.
So in the way that I love the Predator, but the Predator for me doesn't rank in the same way. I mean, the Queen's not
screaming,
in it that much.
The egg sack.
It's just frightening. Yeah. She is the villain. She's behind what's going on, and to me, she's top 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a traditional villain in this movie. I think the villain is the company. Paul Reiser represents the company. You know, I represent the company, but I'm not all bad or something or whatever.
Whatever he says,
the audience laughs every time that happens. You know, she's been put into a situation where she's been betrayed, and she's been, you know, now she's taking control of the whole thing.
Awesome.
But you know, when the Queen Alien arrives on the scene, it is a we weren't expecting it. Oh my God, there it is. And then, of course, we have that second climax.
Right.
When she battles it. I mean, that's a... I don't know. She is a representation of all of Ripley's fears.
Right.
But it's not a traditional villain, per se.
Agreed.
It's an interesting...
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't know where I'd put the Queen. I don't think I'd do top 10, but I'm going to do top 20. Top 20.
Yeah.
Or 25, yeah.
It's just so visually iconic. I don't know. It's
visually iconic, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, we definitely need to,
we need to move along.
So let's quickly rattle off a favorite line, guys. And guys, anybody watching this who wants to get in on this favorite line or recast, let us know what you think. Obviously, our man Brian Hurst has been chomping at the bit for this recast. So big things out of you, Hurst.
Oh, yeah.
Let's get to it. Favorite line. What do you guys got?
Get away from her.
You bitch.
You bitch. Yeah, I mean, that's probably my favorite, but I also do love the game over, man.
Yeah.
Game over. Because, I mean, Paxton constantly talked about how he improvised most of his lines.
Oh, really?
That one's improvised, and it's just hilarious.
Why don't you put her in charge then?
Yeah, in charge, man.
Just a waste of delivery.
What are we going to do now?
His delivery is just the best.
I said a line once a day with something.
He's great. So there's the two. There's one when Newt says we should get inside. They come at night mostly.
Oh,
I like that line.
Yeah.
But the one that I really like is early when she meets Bishop. And Riser's like, she had a bad experience with a synthetic, tried to kill her. And we had some dead passengers. And he's like, oh, really? And he's like, yeah. And he's like, what model? He was like, it was a Hyperdyne Systems, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, well, that could never happen now. We have these inhibitors so that we can't... And I'm just watching. It's so hilarious. Yeah. It's like such a science fiction...
They were a bit twitchy.
Yeah,
I love the kind of deadpan.
Yeah, it's just such a science fiction classic, so I think that's awesome. But we have done a recast. The characters here are Sigourney Weaver, Michael Biehn, Bill Paxton, Paul Reiser, Jeanette Gold, and Lance Henriksen. The characters are obviously Ripley, Hicks, Hudson, whoever Paul Reiser's character plays.
Like Blake? I can't remember.
Paul Reiser?
Yeah.
What's his name?
Oh, he's
Burke. And then you have, what's her name? Second time I've forgotten this today. What the hell's her name?
Vasquez.
Yeah. And then Bishop. So we are going to rattle those off because we are running a little short on time. We want to make sure we get to talk about Ryan's movie.
I'll do mine real fast.
Yeah, sure.
Lance Henriksen, Bishop. Mm-hmm. John Rhys Meyers.
It's very good.
Interesting, right?
Yeah.
I just feel like he's young. I
want to steal that from you, but keep going.
Jeanette Gold, who I love. Luis Guzman.
Oh, you're gonna.
I go male.
You're going male. Okay.
Yeah, I think it'd be really,
that's
really cool.
Funny. I like that.
Paul Reiser. How about Paul Rudd?
I thought about Paul Rudd.
That's good.
Right? I did think about Paul Rudd.
He could do it. That's a good one.
Bill Paxton completely goes to too old to do this, but Stephen Wright, who's just very deadpan.
Oh, yeah.
Why don't you put her in charge then?
Right.
Just everything is like,
just change
the tone. Everything is like,
flip it on his
game over, man. Game over.
Game over, man.
That sounds good. Michael Biehn, how about Shia LaBeouf, the crazy new Shia LaBeouf?
Just do it!
I'm pretty excited
to change. Weird, like.
Do we think that his career is going to go in, like, what if he does some crazy shit, like wins an Oscar next year? Like, I wouldn't even be surprised.
I wouldn't either. He's
going off such a deep end that, like, who knows what's going to happen with that guy.
And for the gold, Ripley, Melissa McCarthy.
Oh, get out of here. Really?
Just make a larger power loader.
Jesus Christ.
Instead of like, you know, get away from her, bitch, you come over here, you bitch.
Yeah. That sort of thing. All right. There you go. Good. Very good, Ryan.
What do you got, baby?
There you go.
I'm going to go the other direction. I'm going to start with Sigourney Weaver, Jessica Chastain.
I think
she's battle-tested. Yeah. She's real serious.
Peer-reviewed.
I am going to go Michael Biehn. I'm going to go with Anthony Mackie, who plays the Falcon in the Captain America films. Bill Paxton, I went with Aaron Paul. The same kind of obnoxious, like...
Yeah, I like that. That's a good one.
You know, it's like, I think... And I think it's old enough now that I think if you put a little size on, some tattoos, I think he could be good. Paul Reiser, Tate Donovan, because he's the ultimate shitweasel.
You always use him. Yeah.
He's my favorite. I mean, the shitweasel character, he's just a great shitweasel. Jeanette Gold, I went with Adrian Palicki, who was Tyra from Friday Night Lights, and I think she's Wonder Woman in the upcoming... Is that still happening?
I almost would upstage Chastain, though, I think.
Maybe.
That'd be tough.
She's a tough chick. She's a tough chick. And then I'm going to steal John Rhys-Meyers from you. I thought about Fassbender. I thought about Oldman, but I like Rhys-Meyers a lot in that. So I think that's very good.
I just think it would be really interesting. Good.
I think I like that a lot.
All right. I got to say, I won this one, guys. I'm sorry. I'm going to self-proclaim winner. Jackie Earle Haley for Bishop.
Solid.
He's creepy. He's smart. I went with Michelle Rodriguez for Jeanette Gold because the whole time I was watching it, I was like, this is Michelle Rodriguez 30 years ago.
And Cameron was like, let me just make Avatar and put Michelle Rodriguez in the top.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
Paul Reiser, I went Patrick Dempsey.
That's a great shit weasel. It's fantastic.
In Transformers, he does it. He's just the ultimate shit weasel.
Yeah.
Bill Paxton, I went Matt Damon. And the reason I went Matt Damon is because... I don't know if you guys saw the new picture that came out yesterday of him on Bourne set. The dude's still shredded enough to be a Marine.
Yeah.
But if you've seen The Departed, and he's in the elevator at the end, and if you've seen Saving Private Ryan when he's crying on the bridge while everyone else is fighting, he is the ultimate bitch. In the elevator, he's like, just fucking kill me. You know, like, he's like, I am killing you. And then obviously he doesn't. But, okay, Michael Biehn, Taylor Kitsch, he's rugged. He's becoming that leading man.
Yeah.
But he's not. He's like that same role-filling leading man.
Yeah,
you know, like he was in True Detective. And then Sigourney Weaver, my girl Charlize Theron, got to go with her.
She's really good.
She's strong. She's a great actress. She can do the action thing, and she
Fury Road
is yeah.
Again,
exactly.
Prometheus. She got thrown into an alien movie as a bitch, as a strong woman. All right. So before we discuss which category we think Alien fits into, and before we give away a mug. Ryan, we want to talk to you a little bit about your film. You have a movie coming out.
We have a film coming out called Trace.
So we talked a little bit about this on the last episode, but we're closer to release now. Mm-hmm. We have some key art here we can show.
Yeah, that's the DVD box.
Mm-hmm. There is a trailer that's not out yet that is premiering in October, if I'm not mistaken.
October 5th it will be out.
October 5th.
You guys have seen it.
It is creepy as hell. Awesome trailer. I love horror movies. I cannot wait to watch this movie.
So tell us again for the audience, in case they missed the last episode, how did this movie come to be, and where can we expect to see it?
Well, it's going to be everywhere there's a Redbox, we'll carry the film, and we're really excited about that. That will be out at the end of October, so I believe it's October 27th, I'm pretty sure of that. And then everywhere, starting November 3rd of this year.
Okay.
iTunes, Netflix, Hulu, everywhere.
So what's the story a little bit? Can you tell us a little bit about the movie?
Break it down?
Classic rom-com.
Some death and some black.
It's sort of based around the idea of electronic voice phenomenon, EVP.
Okay.
And the idea that a group of friends inadvertently contact a parallel reality.
Okay.
So there's a sort of quantum physics quality to it. And this thing is now attached itself in a way that can transmit itself into our world, and it's building into coming into our world. But there's a couple big twists, which I won't mention.
Okay. Right?
So that gives you some idea.
What I really liked about the trailer is it reminded me of when I was a kid or younger, and the Mothman prophecies had come out.
Yeah.
And that was when they'd first started to really use sound in that creepy recorded sound.
Mothman Prophecies is, I think, one of the great underrated films.
Interesting. I never watched it.
I love it. I actually, it was required viewing for a few of the people that worked on Trace.
Are there any other films that you, as a horror movie director, you really drew great inspiration from? Ones that, like, maybe you grew up watching?
Sure. The Exorcist.
That's a huge one for you.
Yeah. Especially the elements of sound, which are key to this film.
Yeah, obviously. Sound is phenomenal in the trailer.
Yeah. We had some great sound people that did an amazing immersive a sound mix on this.
How long did it take you to shoot?
Well, it's a low budget film, but I don't, you know, most of the people who have seen it have said, gosh, it doesn't look very low budget, because I had a really intense, amazing crew. We shot it in about 2 weeks.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah.
Cool. Wow.
Long post-production, because there's a lot of visual effects and sound stuff to it, but yeah.
Just the visual effects look like the ones that you see really quickly look like they turned out pretty great.
Yeah, thank you, man.
So anybody watching or listening, if they want to go find some more information about it now or when the trailer does go live, where should they look?
Terror Films. It has a website, so just type in Terror Films. You can go to my personal Facebook page, Ryan Brookhart, and there's information. There's also a Facebook page for Trace.
And if people want to find you or any information you are sharing about it, they can follow you on Twitter, if I'm not mistaken.
Occasionally, I'm there.
At Ryan Brookhart, yes?
Yeah, that's right, at Ryan Brookhart.
H-A-R-T.
Yes. Fantastic. H-A-R-T. all right, so let's finish off our discussion on Alien here. Which category, I mean, I think this is obvious, but...
It's another one just like last week.
Yeah. I mean, is there really even a conversation? There's three action movie categories, guys. There's totally ridiculous, totally legitimate, legitimately ridiculous. One is fall off a cliff of absurdity, like Face Off. One is dead set in the middle, which is like ridiculous meets awesome. It's sort of campy with a great performance in there.
Right.
Almost legit. And then totally legit is like all-time classic. And for me, I guess there was a question that maybe this was the middle category.
I don't know why.
Just going... It's been a while since I'd seen it, and it's not. It's 100% legitimate.
I mean, nominated for 7, wins 2.
Yeah.
Among that are score, set design, costume design, leading actress.
Yeah.
This movie is by far totally legitimate.
Totally legitimate, and in a way, reset the bar for this kind of film. I think that is not hyperbole at all.
No.
So we're all totally legit.
Totally legit.
Last but not least, guys, as promised, we are going to be giving away a mug to a person whose name I wrote down, but I don't have here anymore.
wow.
JLF, if I'm not mistaken, you are on our iTunes review page as the second reviewer.
Yes.
There are 11 reviews on there. We randomly selected one. Hirsch, we love you.
We have more than one mug to give away.
We have more than one mug to give away. I have faith you will get a mug soon. But unless I'm mistaken, at JLF or plus JLF or JLF
plus,
maybe.
The guy that gave us the very nice review about this being kind of like a sports center for action movies.
Yes.
Which is, that's not why we picked him. We just picked one, but... nice review.
Yes, because I'm an idiot and didn't write your name down, and my phone is not near here to avoid radio frequency. So, you should leave in the YouTube comments. No, that's public. You should
get a Twitter and DM one of us.
Yes, Twitter and DM one of us your information, and we will get that shipped out to you as soon as they arrive here. We will be back next week to do...
We will 90% be doing Die Hard.
Yes.
Unless for some reason Ben goes farther in the Ellen DeGeneres look-like contest and is not here. That we'll do a different movie.
Highly likely I'll be here, but if I'm not, we'll do Die Hard another time. Probably Die Hard will be next Wednesday. Guys, one more time, if people want to find you, where can they find you? At Ryan Brookhart. We just said that.
Literally just said that. You can find me at Andrew Guy on Twitter. Looking forward to it.
And if you guys want to find me, you can find me at Ben Bateman Media, Twitter and Instagram.
Do it.
And let us know what you think. We will see you guys next week.
Boom.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.